guest. Welcome. Tell us who you are. And
my name is Michal Yudin. I'm from Israel, living in Tel Aviv. A little bit living in Florida as well.
And same thing, right?
Almost. Yeah. You know, sometimes you hear Hebrew as well there. And I'm a guest of Johanna and Mark Goodwin Friedman.
Good work.
And I'm here on promoting empowerment of women into politics in Israel.
Great.
More women.
And with that, we know that Shula Mitaloni recently passed away. Very successful trailblazer in her own right.
Well, I would say the number one feminist to introduce equal rights. And
she wouldn't call herself a feminist, from what I understand. She didn't call herself a feminist. No, I was reading some stuff in Haaretz. She just saw herself as a trailblazer for civil rights.
Civil rights, yeah. She's really.
All right.
I'm glad to be here.
All right, well, welcome. We're glad you're here, and keep us honest. What did we study last week? A couple of us, unfortunately, weren't here. They were in their own sense of exile in South Florida.
Scouting out houses for
Right, right.
Where were you?
Let's
Florida. Where?
Naples.
The other coast.
Yeah, yeah.
The other side.
So let's refresh it for them. What did we talk about last week? Ben-Gurion, remember that great picture, one of the iconic pictures of Zionist history of Ben-Gurion standing on his head on the beach.
The yoga pose.
Yeah, he learned yoga in his 50s and 60s. That was from the 1950s, that picture. So he was in his 60s. Hey, they're just getting started.
The world upside down.
Let's see.
We talked about the defense.
Yeah, we talked about Hashomer, the guards, and then we talked about the beginning of the Haganah, which literally just means defense. Anything else?
Second Aliyah
and the Third Aliyah, right? The Second Aliyah, they were really the generals who built the state, and the Third Aliyah, they were the foot soldiers in many regards. But the ones, and we talked about the generational differences between the two, right? Coming from traditional backgrounds while being socialists and ideologicals, borderline Marxist communists. Although we also talked about how the realities of Israel made them break from Marxism. They didn't need a middle class, a revolution over capitalism. Even though there was no capitalism, they said that things are different here. We don't have to wait for capitalism, a middle class, to come around to have our sense of revolution. We talked about Tel Aviv, which I think is the most remarkable story of Zionist history. Right? It was founded in 1909, those 60 families on the beach picking seashells to decide their lots. And they divided it actually into 66 lots. And, you know, today, Metro Tel Aviv, forget about it. It's, 1.8 million people or something like that?
The state of Tel Aviv.
Yeah, many people say that's the capital of Israel, and Jerusalem is the capital of Judea, which is, a whole different take on things. A lot of people would agree to that, particularly based on the neighborhoods that you're in. But those are the things we talked about, and we're kind of crossing boundaries a little bit. We talked really 2 weeks in a row about the Second Aliyah. It was, so impactful, so impactful. And we talked about Yuri Greenberg, the great poet, who started out as a socialist and became a revisionist. We talked about a lot. You guys really missed a lot.
Yeah, really.
Now, I hope that you check the bulletin board, the Dropbox.
I'm going to go back and make sure.
Tonight, we're actually going to talk about the mandate. The British mandate for Palestine. We're really talking about 1920 to 1939. We're going to stop in 39, even though the mandate goes till early 48, because we're going to have a whole unit on World War II and its aftermath. And that's when things got really ugly in terms of the relationship with the British. It wasn't nice by the mid-30s, but that's when it got really ugly. If you want to read more, the best book out on the topic is by Tom Segev, who is a well-known journalist in Israel, and it's called One Palestine Complete. One Palestine Complete. That's what Herbert Samuel, the first High Commissioner for Palestine, signed on one of his documents from One Palestine Complete. So it's really a wonderful, wonderful book. And after the course, I encourage you to read it. I know you don't have time now because I assigned too much reading for this week. So I'll try not to do that again. But the problem is the British documented things so well that there's just a wealth of information. All right, before we get started, any questions left from last week or anything else in terms of the readings or what have you? No? Okay, let's get rolling. We're going to talk first about the awarding of the mandate. Does anybody actually know what a mandate is in terms of the political terminology? right? The mandate is something that...
Mitchell? Authorization to be able to govern the responsibility.
Right, and it's something that came after World War I. It came in the Treaty of Versailles, and then there were individual treaties, like with the Turks, there was the Treaty of Sèvres and what have you. It's the awarding of the governing of territories, for this case, that used to be ruled by the Ottoman Turks. And ostensibly what happened, you remember, the British and the French divided up the spoils. Actually, Russia got a little, Armenia got a little, Turkey's borders were significantly shrunk, which has led to battles over the years between Turkey and Greece, right? Particularly when we talk about Cyprus and what have you. They went to war over that in the 70s, and there are periodic conflagrations over that as well. The British already had their eyes on Palestine even before the war ended. What did they do regarding Palestine before the war ended? What did they issue? Not the white paper. They're going to come. They're going to be seven total. Then
the Balfour Declaration.
Balfour Declaration came in 1917, right? It wasn't until November 19th or December 1917 that Allenby, if you remember, comes into Jerusalem. He gets off his horse. He walks through the Jaffa Gate. The Arabs think it's the new Crusades. The Jews think that the Savior has come. Everything is going to be wonderful. So the British wanted Palestine. Why did the British want Palestine?
Protect the Suez.
Exactly. Protect the Suez Canal, because the Suez Canal is where all their troops and trade went through from the Far East, from India. Right? The sun never sets on the British Empire. In 1918, the Brits fully take Palestine. The war is still going on. The war is going to go on until about November of 1918. There's not going to be a full peace treaties until the early 20s for some of the nations that were at war. So roughly from 1917 to 1920, roughly really 1918 to 1920, there's military rule in Palestine. General Allenby and his troops rule Palestine. The Brits have not been awarded the mandate yet by what is now the League of Nations, which is the precursor to the United Nations. But the Brits say, we can't continue to have military rule. It's not a good use of our military power. It doesn't send a good signal out to the Arab world. We're going to turn this over to civilian rule.
It's also expensive.
Right, that's right. It's not a good use of military power. It's very expensive. You know, you don't need to have soldiers being policemen if you can avoid it. And at this point, Palestine wasn't a violent place in the ways that it was going to come violent when we'll see tonight in 1936 the Arab Revolt, the violence in 1929, and what have you. You raising your hand or just... Okay, just making sure. The Brits want legitimacy for their rule, so they turn to the League of Nations, which has something called a Mandates Commission, where it goes through all the rigmarole, the process, the politicking of who's going to rule what and what have you. It's not until 1922 that they actually get the mandate for Palestine. So they're ruling Palestine without the proper authority, as it were, of the ruling nations of the world. Doesn't really matter. Everybody knows they're eventually going to get it. They have no idea what they're in for. All they know is they're protecting their flank of the Suez Canal. At least that's what they think. I'm sorry, it was 1923 when they finally gained the mandate. The first thing the Jews did under British rule, not surprisingly, was to create organizations. Jews are great at creating organizations. You may not be aware of that. All right? You know, two Jews, three opinions, four committees. All right? Five subcommittees and six initiatives, and on the seventh day they're going to rest, hopefully. They set up something called the Zionist Commission. And this was something that was set up by the Zionist organization. So the Zionist organization, which already had an office since 1909, remember, in Palestine, who set up that office?
Arthur Rupin.
Arthur Rupin. if I could find a poster of Arthur Rupin for you, I'm going to get it.
Okay.
You know? He's superimposed on a Superman body.
Oh, yeah, baby. I'll put slack on it.
Okay, let's see. Tangents aren't always as healthy as they might seem. The first goal of the Zionist Commission is to survey the land and to facilitate immigration. Now, that's exactly what Rupin's office was doing. Rupin is obviously key in this, and he's really running everything in Palestine, the Jewish National Fund, and there's something with the Anglo-Palestine Bank, a fund that he's setting up to be able to purchase land for money transfers. It gets very complicated. Remember, Jews love doing this thing. Eventually, this becomes the Palestine Executive Committee, and eventually this becomes what we know as the Jewish Agency for Israel. Then it's called the Jewish Agency for Palestine. We're going to get a little more detail about it, but it really comes on the scene en masse in 1929. The Jewish Agency is called the Jewish Agency because the mandate said that there shall be a Jewish agency to govern the Jewish community. All right. I guess Mr. Schwartzman didn't leave any money for this, so they didn't call it the Schwartzman Jewish Agency or anything like that. It's just the Jewish Agency. The Sachnut Yehudi. The Jewish, if you ever heard the Sachnut, is the way it's referred to. The first, you know, the rule in Palestine by the British can basically be broken into decades. Roughly 1919, 1920 to 1929, then to 1939, then to 1948. The first decade was generally pretty good. There were disturbances in 1920 and 1921 with the Arabs. What I mean by disturbances, and I mean some rioting, and unfortunately some people were killed. But it wasn't huge. It didn't set off massive alarm bells in the Zionist movement. They didn't think that this was a harbinger of things to come. They were wrong, unfortunately, tragically. It was going to get a lot worse. But the 1920s were generally seen as a good time. And remember, we talked about the third Aliyah coming in. The fourth Aliyah came in right after them. The fifth Aliyah wasn't going to come until the 1930s. But this was a time of building. This was a time when factories were coming into their own. Tel Aviv was booming. Tel Aviv was really becoming a European city. It was gridded out. You know, unlike every other city in Palestine, Jerusalem, where you know, I don't know if there is a straight street in Jerusalem. Haifa, certainly not, because of the mountain. You want to go to Bethlehem, you want to go to Hebron. It's not so easy to drive and find your way around these places. It forms to the land, it doesn't form to the plan. And even Jaffa is more crooked in turn, even though it's on flat land as well. Anyone ever spent any time in Jaffa? Yeah, it's a beautiful old city. That's one of the few places in Israel that you still get a feel of an Arab city. You know, other than Nazareth, obviously. Which is still remains a totally Arab city.
Can I interject one small thing? In the city of Beersheba, which was originally designed by Austrians and Germans, there is a grid to down the original Beersheba from like the early 1900s.
Really?
It's actually in a grid, yes.
Yeah, but so it's not much of the city now, right?
It's a teeny tiny part of it, yes.
Yeah, I just remember the area around the mall more than anything else.
But it's, you know, it's just... because Europeans came in and designed it that way.
Right. Yeah, very orderly. And in fact, when the British troops came into Tel Aviv in 1917, one of them said, "Ah, Europe." You know, that's document, I think it was in this book I read that, by Segev. It was just a wonderfully sourced book. A wonderfully sourced book.
Tel Aviv actually has the largest, called White Tel Aviv, the largest...
The White City is one of its nicknames.
Because of the largest number of Bauhaus architecture in Tel Aviv, in the world.
Right. Bauhaus architecture was prominent in Germany in the 1920s in particular, from the Weimar Republic. Unfortunately, a lot of those buildings are faded now, but they're redone them?
Yeah, many of them.
So that they have they're curved, and they're, you know, it's really, and that's actually part of a UNESCO World Heritage Site, which a couple, not too many years ago, they named it as such. All right. So as I said, the British were encouraging businesses to expand. Why would the British encourage Jewish businesses to expand? Any thoughts? Because somebody had to do it. And the Arabs weren't organized. They couldn't do it. So, for example, a guy like Pinchas Rutenberg, who was one of those many great characters of the era, convinced the British to let him start something called an electric company. And very soon he was supplying electricity all throughout the country. And he would later become a delegate to various Zionist congresses and what have you. But there were a lot of Pinchas Rutenbergs around. They were entrepreneurs that were looking to make a good living. It was an open field. And the British couldn't do it all on their own. Remember, we saw pictures of people in Gidud HaAvodah, the labor brigade, crushing stones for roads. They were doing that with the permission of the British. You certainly weren't going to lay a road in the country without the permission of the British. But, of course, they decided to do it from one settlement to another. So it would be more convenient for their people traveling around. It's not dissimilar, by the way, from what you see on the West Bank today, where there are roads primarily from one settlement to another, strictly for Jews. And I don't want to get into the ethics of that, because that's a whole different conversation. Again, as we would like to say, that's for next year's course. Kibbutzim or moshavot are being founded like crazy in this era, and there are very few serious attacks. There are attacks, as I said, in 1920, 1921. One of the writers that we talked about, Yosef Chaim Brenner, unfortunately, is killed by an Arab attack in 1920. He was one of the people who really moved the locus of Hebrew literature from Europe to Palestine. He's very prominent, and a lot of his work survives today. Overseeing all this was the first what's known as the High Commissioner for Palestine, a guy named Herbert Samuel. And we have a picture of Herbert Samuel, and he looks as British as they get. Let's take a look and see him. Excuse me. There he is. There's Herbert. That's a pretty British looking guy. Our era of great beards is gone. We're now entering into the era of proper Englishmen. I'm going to tell you a little bit about him, and then we'll read the quote there. He was born in 1870. He lived to 1963, so he was 93. He lived a nice long life. He was really a prodigy in politics in Great Britain. He was Jewish, which was unusual at that time. Wasn't strictly Jewish, but it wasn't in question. He was a member of the Jewish community and felt proud of that. In fact, I think it was when he was in Oxford, so you already know he's bright. When he was in Oxford, he renounced Jewish religion, but he said, I still want to be a part of the Jewish people. One source I read said that he continued to keep kosher, but another didn't say anything about that, so I'm a little skeptical of it, because I don't think you'd continue to keep kosher if you didn't have to feel you had to keep kosher, because it's crazy, even though I keep kosher, that's why I can say that. Most depressing thing I've ever done is look at the regular meat in the supermarket and the cost. It's really, really depressing. He enters politics. In 1902, he's first elected to the parliament. He's a rising star. By 1909, he's already in the British cabinet. So in 1909, he's already 39 years old at this point. 2 months after Britain enters World War I, he circulates a memo that includes this. I'm assured that the solution of the problem of Palestine, which would be much the most welcome to the leaders and supporters of the Zionist movement throughout the world, would be the annexation of the country to the British Empire. He's not alone in already thinking about Palestine as the spoils of war, despite what we know is going to be a long and horrible war. Remember, there are many Christian millennialists, including Lord James Balfour, in Great Britain that have their eyes on the Holy Land. They see it as part of their mission to help the Jewish people. There are others who don't feel that way, but these people are going to rule the day at certain critical moments within a decade or two. Excuse me. In 1920, he's appointed the High Commissioner of Palestine, as I said, and he stays in that position until 1925. He is the first Jew to govern the land of Israel, the full land of Israel, since really 67 CE, when the first revolt against Rome started. And obviously, King Herod, and it wasn't Herod at that point, I can't remember who the king was in 67. Herod was a little earlier. Nonetheless, he was the first Jew to fully rule the land of Israel. So it's significant in that remark, and we're starting to see a pattern taking place here, right? We saw with the Jewish Legion, the first Jewish soldiers in a strictly Jewish unit in the Zion Mule Corps since 132, 135 CE and the Bar Kokhba Rebellion. You can see his name today, by the way, at the intersection of King George and Jaffa Streets. I don't have that picture. I'm sorry, I didn't put it in here. The Sbarro Pizza that was bombed in the Second Intifada. The side of that building has the plaque that says, dedicated on this day by Sir Herbert Samuel, with the date, and it's in Hebrew and English and Arabic. So when you walk around Israel, of course, everything seems to have some sense of historical significance, but you can say, hey, there's Herbert Samuel. I studied about him. I learned about him. Not everybody, of course, is happy that there's a Jewish High Commissioner. Does this surprise anybody? Not at all, unfortunately. But listen to who's not happy. Both the Arabs and the British military. The British military is loaded with Arab sympathizers because they say the Arabs are the vast majority of this country. We need to ultimately give them independence the way we're giving Arabs independence in Syria and Lebanon and Egypt and what's now Transjordan and is about to become Jordan. And by the way, the League of Mandates, League of Nations Commission on Mandates says that you're only ruling here until you give the power over to the native population. Right? And for them, the native population is the Arabs. Allenby wasn't enthralled by any stretch with the Jewish community. He wasn't particularly anti-Jewish, but he was leaning toward the Arabs, and a lot of his lieutenants were much more so the case. He said, Allenby said that appointing Samuel, High Commissioner, was handing the country over at once to a permanent Zionist administration. The Muslim Christian Association, in a telegram to Allenby's chief of staff, you have up here the second quote, said, Sir Herbert Samuel is regarded as a Zionist leader, and his appointment was seen as a first step in formation of Zionist national home in the midst of Arab people, contrary to their wishes. Inhabitants cannot recognize him, and Muslim Christian society cannot accept responsibility for riots or other disturbances of peace. This is a pattern we're going to see over the next 20 years or so, that the Arabs are going to say, then we're not, if we don't get our way, we're not responsible for what's going to happen, while they stoke the flames.
Who specifically appointed him?
The British government.
So, I assume they knew they were appointing him
to Lloyd George.
Absolutely. There was no question that he was Jewish. And in fact, this was... it was Lloyd George at that point in 1920. And this was heavily debated in the House of Commons and in the newspapers of the day. There was a lot of editorials written about it. Ultimately, it came out in favor, but there was a sizable dissident minority that were against this and said, this is bad for our long-term policy. And from the British perspective, I think it's an understandable policy. You know, I always say, I like to understand what my enemies are thinking, and I can see it from their perspective, even though I decide to make a choice. Yeah.
If you look over the entire British Empire, which had many different components, I mean, I believe that the history generally is that the military and the colonial administration never really showed a lot of compassion or assistance to nationalist movements. Why
right.
is it that here, there was some sympathy to the Arabs that continued on, even to the point of forming the Arab Legion, right in the 40s. What was it? Why was it? Was it anti-Semitism? What?
It was part anti-Jewish, but it was also a lot of it was the Arabs were viewed as one nation whole. Palestine wasn't viewed individually, and they needed oil for the war, and they didn't know when the war was coming. They knew the war would come. At this point, it's too early to be thinking about the Second World War.
That wouldn't be the military, would it? That would maybe.
Yeah, the military wants fuel. All right. Military wants fuel. Fuel becomes increasingly important in the 1920s and 30s in particular. World War I, we're still using horses in some areas, and we're using mules to transport ammunition and supplies back and forth. That's going to go out the window in the late 20s, early 30s. And the British obviously continue to be involved in various small skirmishes throughout their empire, defeating nationalist movements. And you're right, they're very, very harsh against some nationalist movements. We're going to meet Ord Wingate in a little bit. And he was very harsh against the Arabs. He happened to be a Zionist in his own right, and it cost him his job. But they're very harsh against, and the policies they used were really things that they couldn't get away with today. One thinks.
I can understand where the British would favor the Arabs. I mean, there's just so many more of them.
Right.
At the time, they had so much more land under their control. Egypt is an Arab country. Iraq is Arab. And why would they favor a tiny minority of people?
Keep in mind, at the end of World War I, there are 56,000 Jews and about 450,000 Arabs.
In Palestine.
Yeah,
but Egypt's 100%.
Right. I don't know how many, obviously, at that point. But right, and then so on and so on. And they're also trying to cultivate good ties with Faisal and his sons, because they're going to need them for various revolts or to stem the tide of the Russians coming in or what have you. It's realpolitik at its finest. And to a lot of people in the British government, not just the government, but in the population, Palestine wasn't the Holy Land, it was just another place that they ruled. And there was nothing intrinsically valuable about the land of Israel other than its historical value, and maybe in a value in terms of Christianity, if you're really interested in that. It didn't have oil. It didn't have any other supplies other than oranges coming out of Jaffa. It was nothing major at that point.
There, and I think a certain degree of British arrogance as well. I mean, the Jews couldn't be wogs.
Right.
And so the British arrogance, you know, India and that part of the world. I mean, that was the British view, so they could deal with people, but only in their own superior way. I think Jews were different because Jews had a much more European background.
Right. Well, I think you're right, and I think one of the things to point out, too, is that the Jews were different in that they had a lobby in Great Britain that was somewhat strong. Chaim Weizmann was there. He's very persuasive. He has access to a government that's very favorable of him. And some people don't like that pushback. So that's one of the issues going on there, too. But I think everything you said is absolutely accurate. Absolutely accurate. Nonetheless, Herbert Samuel tried to satisfy both sides. So, for example, which was, of course, impossible, and always was impossible, and in many regards you feel for the British, they weren't going to win this battle, and eventually they did just give it up. He enabled Jewish immigration at times, but he also clamped down on it at times, too. And, very tragically, he chose an Arab nationalist, the Mufti, to be the Mufti of Jerusalem, Hajj El Amin Husseini, whose name is spelled a million different ways in various books. And this man would not only fan the flames against Jews until he was kicked out of the country in the late 1930s, but he would spend World War II in Berlin helping Adolf Hitler.
Just read an article today. There's a new book out that's, the facts are being disputed, saying that he was actually it was just very interesting because it's being disputed whether that's true or not. But both he and Nasser eventually also were very much behind Hitler and wanted to stop him.
Very much.
And helped to stop immigration to Palestine during leading up to and during.
Yeah. And we're going to talk more about the Mufti when we get to the section on World War II. But unfortunately, the Mufti lived a nice long life and died in 1973 in Beirut. In great comfort. And that's one of the great tragedies of the modern era. The more I read about the Mufti, the angrier I get. Because one of the strategies of the Mufti was, by the way, you should know that the Palestinian Arabs were not monolithically against the Jews. There were moderate clans, and it's a clan-based society. The Nashashibis were the main clan in the Nusaybas, and they still have descendants that live in the old city of Jerusalem today. We're trying to moderate and come to an agreement with King Abdullah of Jordan. We're trying to come to an agreement with the Jews, the Israelis, after 48. But the Husseinis and their followers won the day, unfortunately, very tragically. During Samuel's administration, the first of the British white papers came out. You mentioned the white paper. The British, if anything, were great at documenting everything that was going on. So they either had 7 commissions or white papers to try and reinterpret the Balfour Declaration and what it meant at this time and in this place. This happened after the rioting of 1920 and 1921. By the way, in the rioting in 1920, Jabotinsky was put in jail for a while. Then he was eventually released. But that absolutely gave him great street cred, credentials with the radicals in the Zionist movement. There were 7 papers or commissions in all. This first paper, which came out in 1922, was under the authorship, at least in name, of a guy named Winston Churchill. Winston Churchill was the British secretary for the colonies. Remember how large the empire was at this point. So he was the secretary for the colonies. 1922, he releases a white paper to clarify the meaning of the Balfour Declaration. It's the first document that uses the phrase the absorptive capacity of the country, which is meant to talk about immigration, which is really about how do we control Jewish immigration coming in, which is a way that we can pacify the Arabs. So let's take a look. Actually, that's in 1929. Actually, I didn't put the quote up. We're going to get to that. That's Hebron. This is from the Churchill White Paper. And one thing I will say about the British, they write very well. They really do. These are good. And all these documents are online. You can read the full thing. I wouldn't necessarily recommend it. I've done it, but you can feel free at any point to go ahead and do it. So listen to this. Phrases have been used such as that Palestine is to become as Jewish as England is English. His Majesty's government regards any such expectation as impracticable and has no such aim in view. They would draw attention to the fact that the terms of the declaration referred to do not contemplate that Palestine as a whole should be converted into a Jewish national home, but that such a home should be founded in Palestine. During the last two or three generations, the Jews have recreated in Palestine a community now numbering 80,000. It is essential that it should know that it is in Palestine as of right and not on the sufferance. That is the reason why it is necessary that the existence of a Jewish national home in Palestine should be internationally guaranteed and that it should be formally recognized to rest upon ancient historic connection. Very nice language and extreme limiting of the Zionist vision of what's supposed to take place. And the Zionists were very, very upset at this. This was a direct slap at Chaim Weizmann, whose rallying cry was, we're going to make Palestine as Jewish as England is English. So they directly took the phrase there. So now we have not that Palestine is to become ultimately a Jewish state, which is what self-rule is supposed to mean to the Zionists, but we have there will be in somewhere in that territory a Jewish national home. We're not telling you how big it is. We're not telling you where it's going to be, but there's going to be some type of canton in there. Because after all, you guys are a minority of a minority. Now, of course, the flip side of that is allow open immigration and it won't be such a minority. Particularly when it comes to the 1930s, when people are trying desperately to get out of Europe. And one of the only places that they can go is Palestine. And even then, huge, massive numbers didn't go. All right. So it sought to. The other thing that it did is it sought to establish some self-governing apparatus for both Jews and Arabs and united together. Because remember, the British continually looked at the country as a place where Jews and Arabs lived, or Arabs and Jews lived. They looked at institutions as serving both populations. They didn't look at separate populations developing, which is exactly how the Jews saw it. The Jews were all about institutions and organizations that would serve Jews. And ultimately, they would become criticized in other documents, other white papers. All right. One thing the Jews did fight, however, was the setting up of a representative legislative council. Almost every British white paper calls for a representative legislative council. Obvious reason why Jews don't want that. What is it?
They're a minority population.
Exactly. And what's going to happen?
The Arabs
are going to overrule everything. And if they get their hands on immigration policy, it's going to stop right then and there. So there was a lot of, again, realpolitik going on. It didn't matter, though, because the Arabs didn't accept even that, even a representative legislative council. The Arabs didn't accept it because they didn't want to give an iota of legitimacy to the Jews. And that maximalist position truly hurt Arab nationalism in the Mandate period. They could have gotten so much more, and I'll make the commercial, and it's absolutely true today that if the Palestinian Arabs had accepted various deals in the last 20 years, they would be much further along than they are today, from their perspective.
I mean, if the Arabs can't get democracy within themselves in 2014, how would you expect them to have democratic processes in 1920?
It's easy for us to say that now, but think of the British, they're fresh off victory in World War I, they're ruling, I don't know, a fifth of the planet or something like that. They believe that they can bring civilized Europe to the Arab world. So you have to think of it that way. Don't think of it what we know today. It's very different. I hear you. Time and place is critical for all this stuff. this is when, by the way, 1921 or 22, the Jewish Agency in its first formation came into being. We're going to get more into that in a little bit. So the years in the 19... Any questions until now?